Blog Talk Radio.
February the 17th, day number 48 of 2016. Tonight we're going to be chatting with our good friend Leslie Eastman. And you know, every time we talk to Leslie, something very exciting happens, and tonight is no different. We're going to be talking about love and romance in the old days of Egypt. It's a fascinating topic, and I'm sure Leslie has quite an agenda for us tonight. We have a very special guest as well, Dr. Eric Wells, who's going to be joining us, and we'll get a couple of phone calls later on from some of you listeners about the topic. So this is a absolutely fantastic topic. You know, in the, 8 years that I've been doing the show, I have never talked about this topic. So as a radio host, you love talking about things that you haven't done before. And this one is certainly one of them. So we'll have Leslie here in a second. On this day in history, we want to take you back to 1801. Thomas Jefferson was officially elected president on this day. You know, it took them a little longer back then because they didn't have computers and stuff like that. But it was on this day that they finally got the Electoral College voted on. So he became officially the president-elect. And then, of course, on March 4th, they used to do it later back then, too, he became the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, 1801. We're going to take a little break, and we'll have Leslie in just a second. Well, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and let's say hello to our good friend Leslie Eastman. How are you, Leslie?
Very happy to be here, and a belated happy Valentine's Day.
Well, the same to you and to all of the listeners. We, in the past, have done several Valentine's Day shows, and this year, for technical reasons, we couldn't do it before, but it doesn't matter. Valentine's Day is every day of the year, so we will do it We will do it today. But Leslie, you know, as I was saying in the introduction, I've never done a show like the one we're going to do tonight. It's certainly not the topic, so I'm really looking forward to our guest, Dr. Eric Wells. But let me begin by just asking you a couple of general questions. First of all, this topic, how did you get interested in this topic? And there's also a related question to that is about Egypt. You know, did they have a day like Valentine's Day, or a day where couples would celebrate their relationship or their marriage or whatever it may be? So the topic, what got you interested in it?
Yeah, well, the two first part is your question is that I can't remember a time when I wasn't. And I think it comes from my father having introduced me to ancient Egypt in his wonderful 1941 book series, which had all sorts of pictures and all sorts of history, you know, infused in this one article specific on ancient Egypt. Fell in love with the dress, fell in love with the personalities depicted there. And I think one of the aspects of ancient Egypt that appeals to me, and probably to a lot of other people, is that there are enough records that we're able to grab onto as we get a sense of the personalities behind the statues, behind the mummies. You know, Egyptians, you know, for the most part, seem larger than life. But when you go back, they're as human as we are today, they have the same needs, the same wants, the same desires. And so there's a connection that's very personal that you feel with the ancient Egyptians that, you know, I don't think is the same as many of the other ancient cultures that we get. So you look at ancient Egypt, you study it, and one of the factors that you come back to is that you're studying the personalities, you're studying the pharaohs, you're studying the actual people names, and it is a, it was so compelling to connect with people who lived thousands of years ago. So that for me is real appeal.
Let me ask you just a quick follow-up to that before you get to the next question. We should tell the readers, of course, that you write a blog about Egypt or Egyptian history. So tell us a little bit about that blog. We have a link to it in the show information, but tell us a little bit about the blog and how often you write stories like these.
My main blog, or my personal blog, is called Temple of Mut. And back in 2008 when I established it, it was going to be devoted to, you know, ancient Egypt. What's new, what's exciting, maybe with a little homage to some science, because I have degrees in chemistry, biochemistry, and geology. So it's going to keep up with that kind of news, too. And there are so many wonderful discoveries coming out of Egypt now, expanding our knowledge. And I'm really excited to share that. That was going to be the platform until I became a Tea Party member. And after I joined the Tea Party, I kind of took a side trip into the world of politics, and that's how you and I met. And now I write
for Legal
Insurrection, which is one of the top political blogs and news analysis sites in the whole country. So privileged to be here, but nice to be able to go back to my roots and share my love of Egypt and a really dynamic and excellent new member to the podcasting universe. And those people in your audience who love history, who love Egypt, will want to tune in to Dr. Eric Wells.
Absolutely. Now, let me ask you another quick question. Just from your studies or your reading of the people back in Egypt in those days, did they have a day of the year when they celebrated relationships and love like we do with Valentine's Day, something like that? Did they have a day like that?
Well, two parts of that question. You people don't appreciate that. The ancient Egyptians had a real robust love of passion and sexuality. So for them, like you said before, every day was Valentine's Day one way or the other. But there was were a couple of festival opportunities, including one that is conducted on the Temple of Mut stairs called the Porch of Drunkenness, where people were literally allowed to get drunk and cavort with whoever they happened to be around at that particular time. And it was like the carnival. So as we missed last week because of Ash Wednesday and Lent, you know, the festivity there was more like carnival that leads into Ash Wednesday. So no true Valentine's Day, but, looking at the evidence we have and the tombs and the writings, Egyptians really enjoyed l'amour.
That's right. Well, very good. Well, I tell you what, why don't we say hello to Dr. Wells, Dr. Eric Wells. Dr. Wells, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me. Hopefully my connection is okay and I sound okay.
You do? Everything sounds fantastic. It's a great honor to have you. Leslie, I'm sure, has a lot of questions for you, but let me just ask you a couple of general questions and then we'll have Leslie get into more specifics. How did you get interested in, I was just asking Leslie how she got interested in Egypt. How about you? How did you get interested in that marvelous country of Egypt?
I think very, very similar to Leslie. It's one of those things where I actually can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in ancient Egypt. I actually had a detour in school, so I was always knew I wanted to do history, but my two great loves were 20th century American history, specifically focusing World War II and Cold War studies, and ancient Egypt. And for a while, I was thinking I was going to go more the Cold War route, but then I ended up going back to ancient Egypt, and my mom was saying, oh, I knew you'd always want to do this, and was pulling out, you know, some of the pictures from some of the great exhibits that had come through Los Angeles that she took me to, or as she says, kind of I begged her to take me to as a kid of 8, 9 years old. So it seems like one of those things where for me it was always a passion. And what really draws me into it, or what I really find fascinating, is just the length of time that Egypt existed as a culture. And what I always try to give Gail of ancient Egypt, you know, the pyramids were built around 2500 before Christ, right? If we're looking at our dating, which means that the pharaohs who built the pyramids were farther away in time from Cleopatra, you know, our last pharaoh, than we are distant from Julius Caesar or Augustus. So we're actually closer in time to the height of the Roman Empire, the Roman emperors, than the Egyptians, the final pharaohs, were to those who built the Great Pyramid. So just that sense of history of one culture is just amazing to me. And to see then how they innovated but still kept some traditions the same throughout the millennia is just fascinating.
Yeah. Let me just ask you a couple of quick questions, and then I'll turn you over to Leslie, who I know has a bunch of them. When we say ancient, give me a time frame. You said 2,500 years before Christ. Give me a time frame.
So I was thinking about, you know, when we would say we have Egyptian culture kind of starting, I would say we're probably talking about 3,200 BC, going to about 30 BC. That's really the time frame when we have a solid Egyptian culture, when Egypt, which is referred to as the two lands, is pretty much unified throughout that period for the most part. And we, at that point, have kings who depict themselves in the same way. And even though there's not this idea of a monolithic Egypt that never changes, we really have the roots of the civilization throughout that entire period. So I would say we're looking at over 3,000 years before we actually have the Romans coming in and putting an end to native rule.
So we're talking almost 5,000 years ago. I mean, we're talking a long time ago. When you start from now and go back, you're talking 5,000 years. Now, you also have a blog, right, or a website that where you write about Egypt. Tell me about that.
So I have my website, Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt, and I do some writing on there, but really that's more of a place for me where I advertise the podcast and try to make it interactive with my podcast. So sometimes just because of some of the things we talk about, you need to show images, and I'll put them up there as different posts. And that's actually something that people really seem to enjoy. So many people are really interested, especially in ancient Egyptian art, you know, all of these gods with animal heads, or sometimes human heads and animal bodies. So that seems to be some of the stuff that people really like seeing and hearing more about.
Yeah. Well, it is fascinating, like Leslie was saying. Let me bring Leslie in. But like Leslie was saying at the introduction, that what's really fascinating about the Egyptian culture for somebody like me who doesn't know much about it is, you know, the way they dress and some of the images. But let me bring Leslie in, and she has a couple of questions for you.
Yes, Eric. I would like to begin by directing Eric's Guide to AncientEgypt.com is the website. That's one, because I literally binge listen to all your podcasts, and they are all incredible. I want to give you some kudos. Brilliantly put together. You have material that appeals to the excited amateur like myself, to professionals who you actually have on. Your voice is awesome. The presentation is interesting. And one of the approaches I really like is that you have it kind of consolidated, where you can just listen to one podcast and get it. You don't have to, it's not like you're coming into the middle of a conversation. And that is really such a gift. And you love history. Yours is one of the best podcasts out there, and it's relatively new. So I feel like we're getting on the ground floor of what will be amazing Egyptology media career. So,
well, thank you so much, Leslie. That's very kind. Yeah, I've only been doing this for November, so it's still been very, very new. But I really appreciate the way you said that you can kind of just listen to one or two or all of them, because the thing I really wanted to avoid was people feeling like, you know, they were going to class and that this was something that they had to listen to or go back and listen to 10 or 20 episodes. So I really do try to take away any sort of narrative, because I know some people might just be interested in King Tut and other people might just be interested in, you know, Nefertiti, say, for instance. So they can pick something that they like and skip over those things that they don't.
Yes, and I think that's an important point. And again, I encourage, you know, everybody to, you know, go to that website or follow the path from the Temple of Mut to my link to your blog. My, since this is our Valentine's Day show, you actually, your podcast that's up is called Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And before we get into the meat of the podcast, one thing I wanted to share with you is I have been an Egypt lover since I was a little girl.
Leslie, can I stop you? Can I stop you for a second, very quickly? I'm getting a lot of scratch on your line. I don't know if you can hear it. And I was wondering if maybe we just have a bad line. If you wouldn't mind calling
back.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I can't hear that, but I will call you back on the other
day.
Yeah,
please.
I'll throw Eric the question. Eric, while I get back online, comment about the general relationships between men and women in ancient Egypt. What were a personal relationships like?
Great. Let's do that, please. Thank you, Leslie.
Sure. So one of the things that's, I think, most interesting about relationships in ancient Egypt is, first of all, the power dynamic, relatively speaking, and I say relative because in general, the ancient world was not a good place for women and for women's rights. And in general, ancient Egypt, women had a lot of power. You know, we have documents where women came into their marriages with property. They could form their own wills. We have one great will called the Will of Now Nacht, where she talks about her ungrateful children and she doesn't want to give some of her children some of her possessions. But that also tells us that she's coming into a kind of second marriage with property that she herself is keeping for herself and deciding how to dispense it after she dies, independent of her husband.
Right.
So
Leslie back, by the way. One second, Eric. We got Leslie back.
Of course.
Leslie, thank you very much for doing that. We were getting a lot of scratch, and I didn't want the audience to lose out on what you were saying. But go right ahead, Leslie, and go right ahead, Eric.
Sorry about that. Yeah, so the meat of it is that the ancient Egyptian women, relative to most ancient people, had a lot of personal power. And
absolutely.
So when you're talking personal relationships, one thing that struck me in the British and Louvre is that there are a couple statues all over the place. When the Egyptians died, they put into those tombs aspects that were important to them, statues, personal items, furniture, food. But the statues themselves, there are so many of the husband and wife as a bonded couple of nearly equal size. What kind of meaning would that possess to an ancient Egyptian doing that?
So the meaning is definitely layered in a couple different ways. First, the ancient Egyptians really believed in the power of representation, the same way that we think about when we think about voodoo, that you can draw an image of someone or make a doll of them, and that by affecting that image, you would have the power to somehow affect that person. They believed that same thing about statues of people, about tomb images. So by creating a beautiful image with you perhaps seated with your husband or with your wife and your children and receiving offerings, you were giving that image the power to recreate that in perpetuity, so that forever you're going to be together. There's another also important function, and I'll try to not be too racy, but the Egyptians were so much about fertility and about sex. And whether it's the death and then the eventual resurrection of Osiris, or whether it's the creation of the universe itself, those were things that began with male, particularly sexuality, because in ancient Egypt, it was thought that the power of fertility lay with the man, and the woman was a vessel that was meant to protect and nurture that seed. So when we have these husbands and wives, oftentimes we'll see that it's meant to somehow aid the male in his rebirth, because his wife, or sometimes you'll see images of different women or of dancing girls, depending on the scene, and that's supposed to, we think, encourage the kind of fertile juices of the man going, and that's going to help him to be reborn in the afterlife, because that's how the gods themselves were brought into existence, were through acts of sexual procreation, really originally with themselves, and then once those gods were created, they went on to create other gods.
Yeah, so I guess the Egyptians didn't realize that they were Catholics, right? The Egyptians were the original Catholics with lots of babies, right?
Oh yeah. Although we do have some evidence for birth control, but what I always say with that is we've got this one recipe for birth control which involves crocodile dung. So what I would say is,
okay,
I don't know if the dung would be effective, but the smell probably would be.
I can speak to this as a chemist, because I can be your designated chemist. If you are my designated Egyptologist, I can be your designated chemist. I've got degrees in chemistry
absolutely.
And biochemistry.
All right.
So, yes.
Well, I tell you what, Leslie, can you wait one second? Because I wanted to take a quick break. We'll take a quick break right now. We'll come back with Leslie. We also have a caller that wants to say something. So we're going to take a little break, and we will be right back. The music of my good friend Carlos Guedes, and I just wanted to say something about Carlos very quickly. His father passed away, a great gentleman, and Carlos is a great musician. So my best wishes to Carlos and his family. I never had a chance to meet Carlos, but nevertheless, an absolutely wonderful human being. Leslie and Dr. Wells, just out of curiosity, how many children did a typical family have back then? They must have been quite a few.
Yeah, it could really depend. And well, first, please don't call me Dr. Wells. Call me Eric. I'm not very formal.
Right.
So.
Okay. All right. Very good.
It always makes me feel a bit uncomfortable with the titles. But to get back to your question, it seems like a lot, especially because we do know, and it does seem the evidence does indicate that infant mortality would have been very high. So we see that especially for the nobles, because really that's really where the best evidence is. You know, the average poor person, they can't afford a tomb, they can't afford a coffin. So when we have left are images from the elite, and we see that many of them did have children. Sometimes we can see really, really nice, large, as you would say, Catholic families of, you know, 8, 9 children. Other times we can see, you know, 3, 4 children. Mm-hmm. Certainly the kings had many, many children. You know, we think Ramses had probably easily over 100 children, one of the great pharaohs. But he lived for a long time, which helped. So definitely lots of children.
Here, I like to ask a little favor of both of you. Leslie, we have a caller from the East Coast, and I know it's kind of late in the East Coast, so I want to get Amarilis in, and then we'll go back to your question. So let me say hello to Amarilis. How are you, Amarilis?
Very well. Thank you. And you?
Just doing absolutely great. I should point out to Eric that Amarilis is a author as well as a lover of romantic novels. So go ahead, Amarilis.
Well, this was fascinating. You had it on your site, and I was looking up information on a priestess and a priest from Egypt, and I got caught up in the music. I was going to ask a question about the music, because from studying Old Testament, I love to study the Hebrew background and Old Testament. They really believed that the music, the praise music, brought down God. And I wonder if this fellow, Kahai, I think it is, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, he was a musician. I wonder if there was a connection with his wife being a priestess, and maybe his music. And I know there's so many instances in the Bible where a prophet wanted to prophesy and wanted God to come down, and so they played the harp, or there were times they would sing before battle so God would come. So what do you think? Is there something connected here?
Well, Leslie and Eric, go for it.
Dr. Eric, I will concede the floor to you.
So I would say that there's definitely an aspect of that. One of the rituals that we have that would occur in the temple every day is what we call the daily ritual. And it was thought that the statues that they had of the god were a place that the soul of the god would actually descend into, and that they could then care for the god in the form of the statue. And part of that ritual, we can see, was not only offering food and drink and incense, but we would have, especially women, we would have these troops of women who would sing, they would shake rattles, we would have clapping and percussion, and that music was part of what kind of drew the god and then was something that they did to satisfy the god. So it was certainly something that the Egyptians used to please the god and to bring them down. We also see some evidence for some of our magic wands and things that we think possibly they were actually clappers, where they would be clapped together to kind of create a sound, and that was a way that by making, you know, a really brash sound, that would serve to drive out evil spirits. So they certainly did have a belief that music was something that was powerful and that they would use. Unfortunately for us, the Egyptians, like Hebrew, when they were writing, didn't express their vowels. But since Hebrew kind of carried on and we have it spoken today, and we also have some other Semitic languages that did include the vowel, so we can reconstruct ancient Hebrew. We really can't with Egyptian. So we do have some songs and we have some hymns. They seem to be about meter, less about rhyming, but it's very hard to recreate what they would have actually been performing.
It's interesting that the belief extends then to Africa. I've done a little research too on the Santeria religion and in their Bembes, that's how they call down their gods too, with music and with the drums and all. So it's really interesting to believe how much power music has. But thank you. That's very interesting.
Of course. Thank you for your question. I don't know if Leslie has anything she'd like to add.
No, I totally, you can see that. The instrumentation must have been interesting, but doesn't the ancient Egyptian, didn't they, if I recall correctly, they translated it based on what's spoken Coptic language, so they get a sense of how it's pronounced from the Coptic language of ancient Egypt, of Egypt today, excuse me.
Yeah, that's the best we can do. So people often will think that Egyptian is spoken in Egypt today, and it's really not. It does exist in the Coptic church as a liturgical language, and Coptic is the final phase of the Egyptian language, came about in about the first or second century AD, and what that is Egyptian written with Greek, with a couple extra letters for the sounds that Greeks didn't have. The language constructions that we use, we use that as a starting point. You're absolutely right, Leslie. The problem that we encounter is, as we were saying at the beginning, the Egyptian language, when we're going back thousands of years, I mean, for anybody who's ever read, you know, forget Shakespeare, which isn't, relatively speaking, too long ago, you know, look at something like Beowulf or Chaucer and that type of what we might say is earlier Middle English, and how different that is from our English today, to imagine what it would be like if we were looking at English as it was spoken 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So we know that there are problems there, but yeah, when we try to make those connections, Coptic would be the place where we would go.
Yes. So, shall we get back to discussing drugs now?
Go ahead, please.
Now we can cover the drugs.
We have a whole segment now, so we've got a good 15-minute segment to do to this. So, it's all yours, Leslie.
Okay. You mentioned contraception and crocodile dung. Yes, it will work, because what it does is it alters the pH of the vaginal area and basically will kill anything that enters in. So it has the potential to reduce fertility like the foams. But what I want to discuss was the presence of the lotus in ancient Egyptian life. And you find lotus depicted in your regeneration and resurrection art. It's in every party scene. And you'll find that they dip lotus into wine cups. And have you ever heard of the compounds that crop up once you do that as part of the drinking and partying that they do in ancient Egypt?
I have heard of that. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Lotus was something where we see them, they would mix it with fat where it would be infused. We see them smelling it. We see them drinking it. From what I've seen, and I've not seen any formal studies about it, but from what I've seen, there are some compounds that would be effective, but it would take huge quantities. So that's a question that you can actually help to answer for me. So if somebody was wanting to have some sort of psychedelic reaction or to gain the effect from, specifically I think they usually refer to the blue lotus as being more powerful, what type of quantities would they be talking about having to digest or consume to get any sort of reaction?
Well, I think you'd be shocked. If you're going for a psychedelic effect, you'd be disappointed. But it's kind of like herbal tea. They have enough with enough phytosterols and bioflavonoids. And those are sort of related to our vitamins, like vitamin B compounds. So it behaves like a ginseng tea. It gives you energy. It makes you feel good. And then they've got, as additional component in there, a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, which is similar to the active compound that's found in Viagra. So it can enhance sexuality as well. Not to say that it's going to have the same impact as Viagra, but if you could imagine, as you already have, in a world where your immune system is impacted by, you know, daily infestations and mosquito bites and bacteria and viruses all around, there's no antibiotics. You're relying on your own immune system to fight it off. Anything that helps that immune system and makes you feel better about life is going to be a big bonus. So the fact that it's so prevalent in the art and it's so associated with wine drinking means that in addition to the feel-good of the hallucinogen, they're going for the health properties, similar to the infusions that many wines and teas have in today's lifestyle.
And similarly, would it be a similar effect? Because we also see in some of the medical texts cannabis popping up as a use. The most powerful thing seems to be getting from Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
Cannabis as
absolutely.
Well.
Used for all the same reasons, to all the same effect as we use it today. And the clever Egyptians putting it in the beer, you know, change a few rules and regulations, you could order, you know, open up a really interesting craft beer place nowadays.
Yeah, I think as we were kind of chatting over Twitter, I'm all for it as long as it doesn't lead to jail.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to have to probably work on changing the rules and regulations a bit. But maybe for my retirement, I'll open up that craft beer place called the Porch of Drunkenness in Santa Monica.
I think it would definitely be popular.
All right, so we hit the sex, the drugs, and the rock and roll with the music. So what I'd actually like to touch on is your earlier podcast, the new developments in ancient Egypt. There are a couple of interesting research activities being conducted, and I was wanting to do a status check on both of them. And the first one, and it's actually your very first podcast, is Nefertiti's supposed tomb that's tucked away in King Tut's tomb. Can you give the audience a sense of what's happened and where they're going?
Absolutely. So just to summarize really briefly, there's been some great new initiatives. One of them has to do with incorporating a lot of technology into our research. And specifically what they did in King Tut's tomb is there's a scholar named Nicholas Reeves, and he said, I think that there are actually hidden chambers in that tomb. So what they've started doing is using different types of thermal scanning to actually see, okay, do we have different heat signatures for different walls, indicating there might be, you know, one wall might be plaster with nothing behind it. One might be solid rock. And they've already come back with that and said that they're 90% certain that there's some sort of hidden rooms or chambers in King Tut's tomb. So that's really exciting. They're now digesting these scans. I don't know why it's taking so long. My feeling is that, at least with that, these are the type of things that, in a way, they want to draw out, because on the one hand, they want to do good scholarship, but on the other hand, I don't think they want to get embarrassed. I don't think they want to do really quickly, let's rush, we have this thing. And then they go in and see what I think it will probably be, which is just going to be an unfinished room, or maybe a storage room that wasn't finished, or, you know, they did have some of these kind of working caches in the Valley of the Kings. We found one of those fairly recently. It's KV-63, and it kind of seems to be like an embalmer's cache. So it could be something like that. I don't think that we're going to find Nefertiti behind there. I would love if we could find her behind there. I don't personally subscribe to this theory, but the for people who are familiar with Nefertiti and King Tut, probably the most prevailing opinion is that Nefertiti would be King Tut's stepmother. That Nefertiti's husband Akhenaten was Tut's father, and that Akhenaten had Tut with a minor wife. So they're right in the same time. So there are some good reasons where we could see connections, and certainly it seems as though some of King Tut's funerary goods are related to her. And yeah, from what I hear, we're probably going to hear results of that, or at least an update, probably within the next 3 to 4 months. I would guess that we would hear something probably sometime around April or May, where we're going to get some sort of update, where they're going to either go in with a camera, they're going to do a full opening. I think we're going to see something like that.
Yeah, it's going to be everybody that I know who follows this is on pins and needles, like, you know, waiting for Christmas for the news. So the next item was the potential chamber in the Great Pyramid. What's up with that?
So, yeah, so this is another thing where they're doing similar scans. They're using different technologies to see how dense the rock is. They're looking at heat signatures. They're also doing, again, as a scientist, you could probably speak better to this than I could. They're actually using drones, bombarding them with different types of rays to actually get a sense of, okay, are we dealing with different types of stone? Because the pyramids were built from different types of limestone. You know, the poorer quality was usually used for the core. The nice Tura limestone, which really isn't preserved, was done to face it on the outside. But the biggest thing that this could tell us is, one, we absolutely, and it seems like there is one, we could have a chamber that we've not known about in the pyramids. Or could see that these gaps actually tell us something about pyramid construction. So it could be that maybe there's not a complete empty chamber behind it, but maybe it's filled with mud brick or sand. And that could tell us that this was possibly part of a ramp, or this is an area where they had wooden beams, where perhaps they were using, you know, some sort of lever system to put rocks into place. You know, I don't know any Egyptologist who would actually say 100% this is how the pyramids were built. We still haven't answered that question. Ramps of some kind certainly would have been used, but whether it was an internal ramp, kind of like Houdin says, whether it was a spiraling ramp that was then incorporated inside, it doesn't at all make sense that it would be a solely one-way external ramp, because in that case, you'd actually have to put more effort into building your ramp than you would your pyramid by the time you got to the top.
I'm a big subscriber of the corkscrew method of its ultimate construction.
I personally am too. That's how I think it would have been built. But one of the things that surprises people about this that they don't realize is that every pyramid is different. You know, it's not as though you go in and there's one chamber and that's it. You know, there were multiple chambers. Some were completely subterranean. Some had rooms inside. Some had multiple rooms inside, multiple shafts. Even back in the 90s and early 2000s, we were still exploring shafts in the Great Pyramid that we hadn't seen previously. So we were going seeing, oh, you know, we've actually got these handles. What is this a plug? What's behind it? So we're still very much trying to figure that out. And all of this technology is allowing it to do it in a non-invasive way, which is great. That's always the goal, is to not have to destroy anything to figure out how it works. And this also, I think, to take a little bit of a broader view, represents what I think is actually a really positive change within the antiquities organization within Egypt. You know, for many, many years, most of us have heard of or seen Zahi Hawass on TV. And
yes,
he is
the face of Egyptology today, no doubt.
He is, and he's ubiquitous, and he's done a lot of good for Egyptology. But Zahi very much wanted, I think, to get away from those popular things. So you didn't hear about pyramid research. You didn't hear about Tut research. That was kind of something where there wasn't a focus on it. It was a focus on the new discoveries, things like the Valley of the Golden Mummies. So now we're actually, with Al-Damadi, the current head, we're actually getting back to some of those things. And I think the Egyptians are really hoping that this will bring tourists back. So I think that, I won't say that it's completely made for TV archaeology and made for TV scholarship, but it is saying, let's look at the most popular things. Let's look at Akhenaten. Let's look at the pyramids. Let's look at King Tut. Let's look at Nefertiti, because their country really is in really bad shape right now. And without the tourists coming back, that, along with oil, always goes back and forth as their top income sources. So they're hoping that that's going to be able to really drive their economy. But so far, it hasn't really been too successful. You know, the current political climate in Egypt is very restrictive. After the revolution in Egypt, going back and forth between when the Brotherhood had taken power, and then now we've got more aligned with the military, but people are saying that it's worse than it was prior to the revolution. You know, there's been more prominent terrorist attacks, and all of those things drive away tourism. You know, people don't want to go on vacation and worry about their safety.
No, they don't. That's so true, which is why Egypt is usually in my prayers and hoping they resolve all the internal trouble and dealing with the terror organizations that have really hurt so much of that beautiful part of the world. So
yeah.
one of the things I like to make is that they think that only 25% or so of ancient Egyptians' antiquities have been uncovered, which means there's a whole lot more to be discovered. And I have two questions related to that. What are you currently researching? What's the thrust of your own personal work?
So my own personal work does a lot with museums. So my specific research is in Egyptian religion, but I'm very much interested in social history. So what I want to know is not how the 1% live, not how the people who built tombs live, but what did the more average person do? And I look at objects called votive stelae. So, Leslie, you'll know what those are, but for people listening, these are objects that look like tombstones. And people would draw images of themselves on them, worshiping the gods. Sometimes they'll have writing on them in terms of, you know, a prayer or some sort of formula to the god. But
it's
kind of
like the yesterday's email to the god.
Exactly. So I look at the ways in which individuals attempted to participate in the religious system, because most people don't realize the ancient Egyptian the ancient Egyptian temples were exclusive places. You had to be elite to kind of penetrate into the temple, and how far back you could go was really determined by your social status. In theory, those rituals we were talking about where they're caring for the god and cleaning it and taking care of it, in theory, only the priest could do that, because the priest, who really isn't acting as the priest but is acting on behalf of the king, has the purity. He's supposed to have not eaten certain foods. He's supposed to have abstained from sex. He's supposed to have completely shaved his body and been hairless. He's supposed to have bathed in a natron solution and chewed natron so that he was pure, so that there wouldn't be any sort of pollution of the god. So it's not as though ordinary people could access it. So I'm really curious for this, to see how individuals in this land dominated by temples and these gods, how they attempted to participate. And they did so in different ways. You already mentioned there were some festivals. Those were a big time when the populace could actually see the god moving in procession. Usually the statue of the god would be covered, but they could, in theory, kind of... Did they choose their own god to worship? Did they worship their ancestors? We see some people going that way as well. So that's what I study. I'm putting it on hold a little bit now, just because I have a book on it that's going to be coming out in about 6 months. So I'm kind of wrapping...
Well, that's good, because in about 6 months or so, it's going to be time for the Halloween show, and I've got topics that we need to talk about. And so we hope to have you back, and we'll promote your book shamelessly, and it should be a interesting read.
Let me take a little break, and we'll come back for one more segment. Let's take a little break, and we'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. We're talking tonight to Eric Wells, Dr. Eric Wells, and Wesley Eastman. We're talking about romance in Egypt. Guys, we've got about 5 minutes, and I wanted to, if I could, Wesley, very quickly jump in. There's a listener who wanted to know, there's apparently a pharaoh or a god in Egypt who only worshipped one god. Can you tell me about that one?
Oh, I'll do my best in 5 minutes. So this is probably one of the most interesting and most controversial figures in all of Egyptian history. He was born Amenhotep. He actually took the throne as Amenhotep IV. And his name means Amun is satisfied. And Amun was one of many gods in the Egyptian pantheon. And throughout his reign, he starts to worship one aspect of the solar god, which was just the sun disk, and that's named the Aten. So he starts to worship the sun disk. It's not depicted in any sort of human form, not depicted in any animal form. It's just depicted as a disk. And he changes his name to Akhenaten, which means one who is effective for the Aten, that sun disk. He founds a new capital. He abolishes the worship of any other gods. He says, I am the prophet, only worship the sun disk through me. He completely gets rid of the traditional mythology. So the idea that there's an underworld, the idea that the sun passes through the body of the sky goddess at night and fights Apophis to be reborn, all of that is done away with. And it's really, really traumatic for the Egyptian psyche. That's a really quick summary. For those of you who are interested, to give you an idea of how I think about this topic, I did do a 4-part podcast series just on him. It was what I actually did right after Nefertiti, and I think it came in at around 3.5 or 4 hours. So the examination of him as a figure is very complex, and it's one of those things, and Leslie, I'm sure, will hear about it. I'd be interested to hear from her. It's also one of those things that I think, for me, every time I talk about him, I change my mind. Was he a fascist dictator? Was he actually somebody who was a deep philosophic and religious thinker? Was it a mixture of the two? Was he just kind of a puppet who was maybe doing this for political reasons, or was doing this in line with the military? Almost every Egyptologist who I know who works on this has their own nuanced ideas about it that are slightly different from someone else.
That is true. That's the nice thing about Egypt, is that there's just enough data there that you can kind of piece together a life, but not so much you can 100% guarantee that your assertions are correct. which makes discussions always so very interesting.
Well, I tell you what, we're just about out of time, and but I do want to second what Leslie said about a Halloween show. If you could join us for a Halloween show, I know Leslie. I'm sure Leslie will wear her Cleopatra costume, and then maybe you can give us a little bit about Halloween. But this is a fascinating topic tonight. We've got just a couple of minutes, Leslie. Any last thing you wanted to say?
Yeah, one last thing. Definitely Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. You want to know about Akhenaten, Nefertiti, what's new, more fascinating tidbits on sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's the place you need to go. Eric, one final question. If there could be one discovery made tomorrow in ancient Egypt, what would you want it to be?
Ooh, that's a really good question. So what I would say for me, because I do like looking at religion, we have to remember that people have been living in these same places for thousands of years. And the great god that most of us have heard of from ancient Egypt is Re, the sun god. And his city was, in Egyptian it was Iunu, but we call it usually by the Greek name of Heliopolis, which is the city of the sun. And if there was some way we could move modern Cairo and get underneath to the ancient city and to actually see what his temple looked like, what that town might have looked like, for me, that would be incredible. Because while we have Karnak and we have Luxor, those are things that are preserved because they're kind of relative backwaters. But to see and imagine what Heliopolis, what the cult of Re and what his temple might have looked like, that's what I would really like to see.
That's a good
fascinating
one.
Fascinating. Well, Eric, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, and Leslie, as always, for putting together these shows. They're absolutely fascinating. I know we had a lot of interest, some people calling in questions and sending in some questions. And we'll do it again, Eric. I mean, just let us know whenever you want to do another one. We'll do another one. I'm totally fascinated by the topic.
Absolutely, Silvio. Leslie, it was great being here. And if you're open to it, we don't have to wait till Halloween. We don't want to bombard your listeners with ancient Egypt, but I'd be happy to do it again in a few months. Ideally, in a few months, we can talk about what they're going to find in Tut's tomb. And we can see what we get in there.
Absolutely.
What I was going to say, Eric, is that our Thursday night listeners understand that Leslie likes Egypt. So I don't think you have any trouble. I think so. So I don't think that's going to be a problem, because Leslie loves Egypt, and we love Leslie, so it's always a lot of fun to have her on. And it will be a great pleasure to have you on. And, in fact, what I'm going to do to say goodnight is dig up a tune that we have here in our collection of tunes that I always play when Leslie joins us. And this is by a Canadian guitarist. His name is John Gilliatt. And the name of the song is Sands of Egypt. So I hope that you like this one, Eric.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Leslie, as always, you're absolutely wonderful. And thank you so much for the program. I hope that we were able to cover everything you wanted to cover, but you know, there's only so much time, so
yeah,
we can do another show.
I knew there's only so
like.
Much time. I was grateful for getting Eric for as long as we did. We'll get him back on to discuss his book and ancient Egyptian magic and all things pertinent to Halloween and any of the discoveries. I'm really excited after tying Egypt into everything I possibly could to find a real live Egyptologist to share with the audience. It's really thrilling. And Eric.
Well,
wishing for your success. Going to enjoy seeing where the new media takes you.
Well, thank you so much, Eric, and thank you, Leslie. And good night to both of you. And we're going to leave both of you with the Sands of Egypt, one of our favorite songs here on the program. Good night, everybody. Good night, Leslie.